Am 24. Februar 2022 startete Russland seinen völkerrechtswidrigen Angriffskrieg gegen die Ukraine. Wir waren geschockt, ängstlich, empathisch. Und inzwischen? Haben wir uns schon an die unmenschliche Gewalt und das Leid gewöhnt? Interessieren wir uns genug für den Krieg in Europa? UkrainerInnen werden täglich beschossen, frieren, hungern, kämpfen und sterben. Millionen von Menschen sind auf der Flucht. Und eine der größten Ängste der UkrainerInnen ist es, vergessen zu werden. Genau deshalb sollten wir ihnen zuhören. War at Home. Stories about life and war from Ukraine.
Hi, my name is Maria Romanenko. I'm a 30-year-old print and TV journalist, originally from Kyiv, Ukraine, where I worked for the Kyiv Post and Hromadske International. Outside of these publications, as a freelancer, I worked for the Business Insider, BBC, ITV, Reader's Digest, Condé Nast Traveler, and other international media. And I currently host a daily program about Ukraine in English called Ukraine in Flames. Since March the 2nd this year, I have been living in Manchester, England.
And my name is Jess Myers. I'm Maria's partner and a multi-award-winning community activist, as well as chairperson of the Spirit of Manchester Awards.
I never saw myself living in England, and I was very happy living in Podil, the historically Jewish and now extremely hipster neighbourhood of Kyiv. But on February 24th this year, Jez and I woke up to bombs all around the country, so we embarked on a seven-day journey from Kyiv to Manchester, where we covered 1,200 kilometres and saw people get crushed to death and collapse after many hours of no food, water or toilet facilities at the border.
I can't really speak Ukrainian, and Maria's English is near perfect. So we will tell this story in English.
Let's start from early February, when I, like a lot of people around the world, was watching all the headlines about Ukraine with fear. Except, unlike most of the people in the world, I was in Ukraine myself. I lived in my hometown, Kyiv. Jez was doing dual living between Kyiv and Manchester. Manchester is where he was born and lived all his life. But starting a relationship with me made him come to Ukraine every month for about 2 weeks at a time. With Valentine's Day approaching, I was looking forward to seeing Jez, who had a Manchester-Kyiv flight booked for February 14th.
Then the FCDO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office, known as the British Embassy to everyone else, issued a warning 3 days before my flight. They changed the status from travel only if necessary to do not travel. I told Maria I wouldn't be coming. I just couldn't go against the advice of my own government.
I'm not going to lie that didn't upset me. It upset me a lot. I was angry and frustrated. I felt like I was left all on my own. And if the war did happen, when would I see Jez again? Flights were already being cancelled at that point because of all of the warnings. Then I decided to book a February 14th flight to Gdansk, where I knew Jez had friends. My thoughts were, well, if Jez won't come to see me, I will go somewhere where I can see him. I didn't have a UK visa, so Poland was the next best option.
Maria had done an interview for BBC Radio 5 Live with Chris Warburton about couples apart for Valentine's Day. At the end of the interview, Chris said, "I hope Jez has something up his sleeves." I didn't. I didn't even have any sleeves on the top I was wearing. But Maria suggested that she would go to Gdansk and I could meet her there, an idea that I was very much in favour of, as it would get her out of the country and, at the time, we thought it would be the last day that flights would be running. The compromise was that I would also come to Gdansk, so I flew over on the 15th to be with her.
We spent 8.5 days in Gdansk. On February 21st, Putin did his crazy speech about how Ukraine wasn't a real country and was invented by Russia, all his usual rewriting of history. Then on February 23rd, I decided it was time to go back home. I honestly did not believe that a full-scale war would take place. Poland, as lovely as it wasn't my home. It was too expensive for me to keep paying for hotels and Airbnbs, so I decided that I would go back on the 23rd.
The costs were absolutely crippling, and Maria also wanted to be with her family. I spoke with a few friends. We all agreed that it was a terrible idea, but what choice did I have? If Maria went back and something happened to her, I would never forgive myself. Either way, she would probably never forgive me, and it would be the end of the relationship if I didn't go with her. Plus, my thinking was that if she was already making these bad decisions, then I had a level of responsibility to protect her from those thought processes.
So we packed and went to the airport. At the airport, I rang my dad to tell him that that's what I was doing. Despite previously dismissing a possibility of a full-scale war, he was suddenly all alert. "It might not be the best time to go now," he explained, but didn't stop me. I also gave an interview to ABC News from the Gdansk airport, talking about how it was important for me to fly back to Kyiv.
It's worth adding that talking to journalists was a big part of Maria and my lives since the beginning of the year. I had given interviews to the BBC and various newspapers like the Sunday Mirror, and Maria had been carrying out work and interviews on behalf of a number of international news channels. One even asked her to head eastwards towards the front line with them. Maria has no formal war training, and it's not even clear that they would have had adequate safety equipment had something happened whilst there.
Two memorable things accompanied our landing in Ukraine. First, a lady a couple of rows back on the plane telling someone on the phone that she arrived, but she wasn't sure if she'd be able to fly back a few days later, given the threat of the invasion. Second, our phones lighting up with the news of the state of emergency that was announced all over Ukraine.
What does a state of emergency mean? Well, not a whole lot really, other than an increased police presence and the cancellation of major sporting events. Frustratingly, it was supposed to be the return of the Ukrainian Premier League after its winter break that weekend, and I had my eye on seeing Dynamo Kyiv play against Inhulets, as well as Ukraine versus Spain in the basketball.
When people talk about Ukraine not preparing enough for a full-scale attack, I think back to the 23rd of February, when everything sort of felt normal, but everybody clearly talking about something imminent. I was not worried, though. Life carried on as normal for me, and that day I worked remotely for a US-based media company. Until my dad rang me and said that I needed to get to his place, 40 minutes outside of central Kyiv, as Podil and central Kyiv in general may not be a safe place that night.
Maria rushed into the kitchen where I was sat, crying, and told me what her dad had said. I said, "Right, pack your bags, let's go." I hadn't unpacked from Gdansk, so for me, it was just trying to fit whatever extra clothes I had available in Ukraine. So my packing took a couple of minutes. With my help then, she repacked her suitcase that she hadn't finished unpacking at that point too, but her concentration was all over the place. Maria couldn't really grasp what was going on. Even in the taxi to her dad's, she was talking about her weekend plans and how she had to be back in the centre for them. We stayed over at Maria's dad's that night, and I watched Manchester United against Atletico Madrid. It was a shockingly poor performance by my team United, and I was grateful the signal kept cutting out, but that soon turned out to be the least of my concerns.
I fell asleep well and had my earplugs in that normally stopped me from hearing Jez's snoring. That night, it also stopped me hearing something more than that, bombs.
Maria's dad's place is located only 30 kilometres away from Hostomel Airport, which sustained heavy damage at the time. Ukraine's victory in Hostomel, as well as Irpin, ensured that Russian troops couldn't proceed to Kyiv. Both these places got occupied by Russia in the first month of the full-scale war. Even though I didn't hear the bombs too, other people in the area did. I woke Maria up at about 7 a.m. when my phone brought me the news of the bombs being dropped all over the country.
Jess shook me and told me the news. It felt like I was in a film, so I kept asking him to repeat. He told me to check my Twitter, and that's where I saw all the multiple reports of bombings. Jess said that he was leaving for the west of Ukraine with the intention of crossing into Poland and then getting back to England, regardless of whether I was coming alone or not. I had to make a very quick decision.
As discussions were had and Maria's dad tried to refuse taking us to Lviv, after previously promising Maria that he would take her wherever she needed to go if there was a war, a fighter jet flew overhead. Clouds were blocking the view, so I couldn't even see where the plane was in relation to us. Certainly could hear it though. Maria's dad finally agreed, though not without first telling me that I had gone down in his estimation. I really didn't care at the time and told him so. However, secretly, I was quite happy that I was high up enough to start with to have a place to drop down to.
His position was that it was a bad idea to go to the border when everybody else would be doing the same. In hindsight, he turned out to be sort of right, as I could not even envision in my worst dreams what ensued.
The journey to Lviv took 10 hours instead of 6. Heavy traffic on our side of the road and long queues for traffic, with some petrol stations running out of it completely towards the west. The lanes towards the Kyiv direction were practically empty by the tanks and military vehicles.
I had witnessed similar scenes, but that was at the Independence Day military parade 6 months earlier. It felt surreal to realize that this was not a one-day demonstration. People are going to a real war. The road we took actually became a mass murder scene just a few days later, as Russians started firing and kidnapping fleeing civilians there. We were lucky to make that journey before that started, and I'm thankful to Jess for making that decision to flee that early. I wish I could say that my whole car journey was accompanied by following the war news, but I was actually on the other end of the news-making process. I gave out possibly close to 100 interviews in the space of 10 hours. This helped me to stay focused. If only I got a few minutes of quiet, I could have easily...
Maria is a smart and determined person, but she struggles with emergency situations. There was one time we nearly drowned because she refused to run away from a fast-approaching tide, arguing that the beach surface was rocky and hurting her feet. For the journey in Lviv, we made it for about 10 p.m. We called at our friend's place where we had a drink and some long-awaited food. We couldn't really eat on the journey. Then we decided what we'd do next. We went to another friend of ours, Kyle, who's from Northern Ireland but lives in Lviv with his Ukrainian partner, and stay with him for the night. In reality, it was a couple of hours of sleep and arrived at 3:45 a.m. when I heard another fighter jet overhead. The three of us rushed to the bomb shelter in the building. It turned out to be a friendly plane, but you don't have the time to find out these things in these situations. I will never forget sleeping fully clothed on the sofa with my winter boots purposely unlaced and opened by the front door so I could slide my feet in and run downstairs if I needed to.
4 a.m, we were already on the road to the pedestrian crossing to Poland. It takes 1 hour 15 minutes by car normally, but the sat nav told us 1 hour 40 minutes. That's good, I thought. We'll be there nice and early to beat the queues and hopefully cross into Poland by lunchtime. 19 kilometers ahead of the crossing, the traffic just stopped and stood still.
Daylight at 7 a.m. showed us what was happening all around us. Mothers with children were saying goodbye to their husbands, aware they weren't going to get any closer to the border, and they were putting their children in buggies and then decanting into a bag whatever they could carry with them for the long walk, the collective sum of their worldly possessions in a carrier bag.
We sat and waited and waited, and then we tried to take a long cut. At one point, we came to a checkpoint and the police signaled that we couldn't go down that road. And the same at the next checkpoint as well. At the final checkpoint we could use, we were told the same, but also had a passport check. Whilst the police officer manning the border was busy, the guard looked at the two UK passports that we had, belonging to Jazz and Kyle, and said, "As a thank you for the support your country has given us, you can go through." We made it to the border at 10 a.m, 6 hours after setting off.
The mood at the border was boisterous and positive. The only problem was that there was a lot of people, tens of thousands. A queue 15 across and 200 metres long to get into the main central pen. This could be a long do, but I estimated 6 hours, how wrong I would be. The queue didn't move, and in time we snuck into the main pen through a gap in the fence. It's not something I'm proud of us doing.
Upon getting in there, it was clear what the problem was. There was a gate with two exits, and armed guards were letting people through at the rate of one person per minute. And the crush was awful. We were immediately greeted with a lady that had collapsed being carried out. It got worse. Over the hours, the crush intensified. Mothers screamed and wailed for a safe passage for them and their children.
There was a woman next to us. I can't remember her name, but she had a black French bulldog called Boomer. Boomer was terrified. Although his position was much more comfortable than ours, Maria allowed him to sit on her tall suitcase as he was looked after by his owner, and many people commented on how handsome he was. But later, the woman decided to move further. She realised that she couldn't carry both Boomer and her own bag, so faced with a choice between the two, she let go of her suitcase, leaving her life behind, and pushed forward to the front with Boomer in her arms.
Very inconveniently for myself, I started my period right at the border crossing, which meant that not only I was struggling to get air to breathe, I also got cramps and weakness and blood running down my jeans. After 8 hours in the overcrowded fenced area and having carried out a BBC interview live, I was close to collapsing. I tugged onto a group of women making a push to the front, leaving Jess behind and making it through the gate before actually collapsing.
Being in the crush on my own was terrifying. My phone kept cutting out as I was stranded away from the Ukrainian phone mast, but not close enough to the Polish one to get a signal there. So I was all alone. As the temperature dropped, tempers and anger rose. Arguments started as fatigue set in between groups of students trying to get out. I lost Maria's suitcase and panicked, but due to the sheer volume of people, despite it being only a few metres away from me, I had no way of easily getting to it or seeing it. Carrying a case brought additional issues. Eventually, I managed to find it and get it back again. As I got closer to the exit, where they were letting people through, the crush became unbearable as people tried to get to the filter point. Every so often, the gate would swing open and a swell would push everyone back, followed by a wave of people pushing forward. Being small, I couldn't see these things happening, so the first I found out about it was someone's back crushing my face and stopping me from breathing.
I did various things to try and get Jez out of the crush. I rang the British Embassy in Poland at first, but they said that there's nothing they could do to help us, as we were on the Ukrainian side of the border, and they couldn't possibly send a Polish border agency employee over to get Jez, as that would be considered a Polish invasion of Ukraine. I rang the British Embassy in Ukraine, who only had a skeleton team working in Lviv at the time. They asked me to leave our details, and they would try to, quote-unquote, figure something out and call me back. But 30 minutes later, my phone was still silent. I rang them again, the same thing. We'll call you when we have something. I started getting frustrated at the fact that Jez's own embassy, that is supposed to be looking after its nationals, wasn't being more active. I was on my own trying to get my partner out of a terrible crash where people were dying. Whilst waiting, I had the boomer lady come up to me and say that she saw a, what she said was a dead guy, being carried out. How do you know that he was dead? I asked. That's what the border guard told me. I got chills. But I knew it wouldn't be Jez, as the boomer lady knew what Jez looked like, so she would have told me. At that point, as Jez said, I had no contact with him.
Some moments later, I hear Maria shouting my name. Jez, Jez. I could just about make her out on the other side of the fence, catching a glimpse of her through the bodies.
Many frantic hours later, Jez made it through too, a guard putting his boot on someone's head, allowing him to dive through the guard's legs. But that was just part one, for we had to queue and crush and push again for the actual border exit itself. The first gate was just a sifting area. In all, before we made it over the border, we queued for 23 hours. No food, no water, no toilet facilities, no sleep, no sitting down, in minus 4 degrees Celsius. Our total travel time, excluding the break in Lviv, had been 40 hours. Jez had 1 hour sleep in 52 hours. I had 3. But we were in Poland, safe, and with the Home Office having lost the tourist visa that I applied for a few weeks earlier from Kyiv, all that remained was to work out how we would get me into the UK without a visa. This was before the UK government opened the two routes for Ukrainian war refugees.
We decided to pay a visit to the embassy in Warsaw to find out where Maria's visa was. There was a queue of people trying to gain entry to England, all being turned away and told to go to the visa application centre, except that was across town and only open a few days per week. At this stage in the war, they really hadn't put the resources in place to deal with the numbers that were coming across the border. But it's different for me. I'm English. It's my embassy, so they have to talk to me and help me. At least that's what I thought. Or maybe I didn't think that because the embassy had done so much in terms of not actually helping me when I needed it so far. I pressed the buzzer and they explained that I needed to come back in 45 minutes. I wasn't happy about this, but it turned out that Boris Johnson, the then Prime Minister of the UK, and Liz Truss were about to arrive and give a press conference. Excellent, I thought. If anyone can sort out Maria's visa, it will be the Prime Minister. So I called up some press contacts and loudly started to explain the situation. Maybe he would like to come out and explain where Maria's visa is. After the third call, there was a knock at the window and I was summoned to enter the embassy. It turned out that the visa had been granted, but it was lost in the post in Kyiv, they thought, and couldn't be reissued. This wasn't good at all. We'd have to completely reapply for Maria's visa, and they weren't even offering those visas anymore. And so my MP called the Home Office, and so did the embassy. And then so did the press. Anyone we could find was phoning up the Home Office, giving the case number, telling them that they were writing an article about it. Would the Home Office like to comment? A few hours later, the phone rang. It was the embassy. They said they were trying to arrange something called a visa waiver for Maria. Miraculously, well, firmly due to the pressure put on them by our MP and the press, they granted the workaround. We were off to England.
It was a relief to get an official permission to come to the UK. But I swear everything was such a blur at the time. I arrived in the UK and there were three camera crews waiting for me, as well as a car to take us to London for the biggest breakfast show in the UK. One TV channel asked me how it felt to be in England and to be safe. How it feels, I asked. I've not processed the events from a week ago yet, and you're asking me to explain how I feel now? I wasn't lying. My head was a mess, and despite fleeing for many, many hours, the whole scale of what was happening in my home country still hadn't fully struck me.
As we settled into Manchester life a little bit, Maria and I went out for dinner. It was the first time we had had a few minutes of quiet since February 24th. I saw a video of a bombed Borodyanka in the Kiev region and showed it to her. We were asked frequently about the war and what was happening. In reality, we were so focused on ourselves, getting out, our safety, getting to the UK and managing the interview request, we didn't have a clue what was going on.
When I saw that video, I broke down in tears. There were buildings turned into ashes and it all suddenly started feeling so much more real. It took about 8 days to kick in. My country was being ruthlessly destroyed by Russia, while the world looked on and discussed possible solutions. I was sat in an Indian restaurant in Manchester, weeping uncontrollably.
We got some food as Maria continued to break into tears from time to time. When we got the bill, the waiter told us that they would cover the cost of our dinner. They saw us on TV, followed our journey, and it was the least they could do in those circumstances, they said.
Can I give you a hug? I asked the waiter. I didn't know how to react. It's one thing to cry because your country is being bombed, because you feel like no matter how much you do, it's never enough, because your friend was killed, which happened to me just a few days later, but more on that in a different podcast episode in this series. But it's a different thing to cry because people are kind to you when you don't expect it. This restaurant episode was followed by acts of kindness in Manchester. People gave me flowers and drawings made by their children saying welcome home and decorated with Ukrainian flags. They offered cakes, drinks, and a free haircut. I was invited to speak at several events, at a charity gathering, at a synagogue, at a poetry fundraiser for Ukraine, at the University of Manchester, at a dozen TV and radio programs. The journalist community was something else, though. A friend of Jez, Nicole Lampert, introduced me to a couple of Facebook groups for journalists, and media organizations started offering me freelance work to the extent that it was hard to keep up with the work and fit everything in. ITV Granada, the local version of the biggest British commercial channel, ITV, asked me to do a TV report about my journey from Kiev to Manchester for them. People and journalists specifically also helped me with some clothes, as when I packed, I didn't know I was leaving the country and only brought two very warm jumpers. Local journalists and media workers just wanted to meet me and find out how I was doing. A couple of weeks after my arrival in Manchester, the government also extended the family visa scheme to engaged couples, meaning that I was able to legalize my immigration status in the UK. I've been living in the UK for nearly 10 months now, but I can't set up a life because all I'm thinking about is going back.
But we both have been helping Ukrainians in Ukraine and in our area of Greater Manchester. I helped several Ukrainians find hosts here, get their visas and settle in, as well as find jobs. Maria started free Manchester walking tours in Ukrainian, and the response has been fantastic. She's introduced more than 400 Ukrainians to my city so far.
Once all of this nightmare is over, Jez and I will return to a free Ukraine. I will hug my dad and my brother who stayed behind to help. I will hopefully see my grandmother who's 92 years old now and been bedridden for a year due to a hip fracture, and my cousin who's got diabetes type 1 and struggling to carry out her treatment with constant power cuts. We will help rebuild Ukraine. Jez, with his management skills and good links in the UK, will advise businesses on how they can invest in Ukraine. I will continue writing. Jez and I are now writing a book about our journey out of Ukraine. There's a lot more that we don't have time to go into here. And when we travel to a free Ukraine, we will produce a documentary about our return, the people who stayed and why, and how everyone can help Ukraine.
War at Home ist eine Produktion von Bose Park Productions und Eld Academy. Alle Folgen des Podcasts wurden innerhalb des Projektes Digital Media Lab erarbeitet und aufgenommen. Das Projekt wurde durch Mittel des Auswärtigen Amtes gefördert und finanziert. Wenn euch der Podcast gefallen hat, abonniert ihn gerne und empfehlt ihn weiter. Denn diese Geschichte ist nur eine von unzähligen, die erzählt werden müssen, immer und immer wieder, damit der Krieg in der Ukraine nicht vergessen wird, damit die Menschen in der Ukraine weiter gehört werden und wir ihnen helfen. Slava Ukraini!